stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, the second half of my interview with jazz pianist and composer Michael Royal. The interview picks up with Michael saying that he moved back to the United States because his mother had died. And so, of course, all of his travels and living and experiences outside of the United States are in the first half of the interview. In this interview, Michael is not only talking about life as a musician, but truly a life dedicated to all of the arts and his philosophy, which underpins the way that he lived and all the experiences that he had. So I'm going to play a cut called Julie's Lament from his CD, Transition, and this is a Michael Royal composition. Richard Drexler on bass and Steve Davis on drums.
My mother died in 1977, so I came back to bury her, found a job in Sarasota at an old Dutch pantry on the corner of Hillview and 41, used to be the Sugar and Spice, but before that, it was the first real jazz joint that this city ever saw, and I started it. It was called T.R. Murphy's. It was run by a bunch of Vietnam veterans from Buffalo, who had made their living selling their expertise in knowing how to party. The people in Florida didn't know how to party. Really. I mean, you'll find in blue-collar towns like Pittsburgh, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, there's this salt-of-the-earth class of people who really get together. I mean, when holidays come, every neighborhood is decorated. Mm-hmm. You know, on St. Patrick's Day, everybody's green, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, and Floridians don't do that, you know. And so this guy, like, brought that vibe down here and kind of taught people how to party. Meanwhile, I've got this steady gig, and I'm going through all this angst because my mother's dead. And so I'm living down here, meet John Lambie for this this Bucky Fuller connection. Meet all these extraordinary people. Jack Bailey, this painter who won the Prix de Rome 3 years in a row. I ended up getting an apartment at the Miramar Hotel. I lived there. Lived downtown for 3 years. And it was great. And I'm going to T.R. Murphy's, you know, 7 nights a week. I started out as a soloist. After 2 weeks, they had a great menu. It was very reasonably priced. It was a very eclectic group of people. It wasn't retirees. It wasn't early bird specials. There were some, but there were, and there were some blacks coming in. There was a lot of young people coming in. There were a lot of old people coming in. A lot of gays coming in. I mean, there's this very, very rich cross-section of people who all got along. And so I said, look, this is starting to happen. So I said, how about you let me hire a bass player? He says, go ahead. So I get this bass player named William Bennett, who I met through Majid. So we're playing jazz now, and it's cool. And I said, look, man, 2 weeks later, I said, how about you let me hire a drummer? So inside of 2 months, I had this happening trio going, and the place is jumping. And it's remarkable because the synchronicity was so incredible. You know, it was the right time, it was the right place, it was the right staff, it was the right band, it was the right menu. Everything was right. And this guy really did know how to party, and he knew how to treat people. I mean, at the end of the night, we could be not busy, and we'd get hit by a bar mitzvah, it was like, you know, 70 people. So all these people come in, and they want to get taken care of, so everybody jumps to what their job is, and we're all having fun being in service to people, and making money doing it. Mm-hmm. Hey, doesn't get any better than that. So I ended up asking him, how about you let me hire this saxophone player, ringer that I know from St. Louis? He's a good friend of Miles Davis. So his name is Bob Gibson. So he came in and we started some shit that this city still has not seen. Jazz Club of Sarasota was 3 years away from being founded.
Wow.
Which that's actually was, you know, the dream of some retired people, one of which was Benny Goodman's manager. And they all had buying power, so they bought all this property in Pelican Cove, and they came down and started a club around what their interest was, which was swing music. And that's how all that got going. And so when they got firmly rooted, and they had a strong financial base. So I left here in 1978 and moved to Los Angeles. Tried my hand at film scoring. Just the pecking order of staying in L.A., and like the quality of the calls was getting higher. So at the end of 3 years, I'm getting the right calls and making good money when I go out. And I mean, people go through all the bullshit you go through in a town like New York or L.A. because if you make a reputation in a town like that, you make an international reputation. So you're willing to go through all the crap. So my wife ends up pregnant with our first baby. And I'm going, let's have this baby. But it's way too crazy, way too expensive. I mean, we had lived there for 3 years, didn't know either one of our neighbors. My time in L.A. was good. I couldn't believe that for as many people there was so little going on from a higher perspective level. It was all pop culture oriented. And everybody was trying to make it, and everyone was trying to be a star, and everybody was showcased, and everybody was blah, blah. So it was such a hollow existence that making the decision to move back east was the right decision. So we went back and had the baby. Well, the plan was to go have this baby, you know, let grandma and grandpa bond and everything and do all that, and then go back to L.A. and pick up where I left off, because that has really established some momentum. Well, I ended up having two. So and I wouldn't go on the road anymore, because I didn't want to miss a tooth coming in. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to miss Cub Scouts. I didn't want to miss L.A. So it's like for 15 years, it was like, we're raising kids. So I lived in Buffalo for 10 of those 15 years, which is where her family was from, my second wife. And again, a blue-collar town transition. There was no work. It was real tough to get work. People were beating each other up over $50 gigs. Somehow, miraculously, I had this wonderful stroke of fortune. They built a new Hyatt downtown. They had rebuilt their whole downtown area like Baltimore did. They got rid of all the drug dealers and the hookers and the seediness of the downtown, and they built this beautiful theater district. And I worked for a company, there was no work, so I went out and got my first straight gig, which was as a project assistant for a event planning company called Events Unlimited. And they gave me the white-collar training that I had never had, that I stepped up to right away. It was very easy for me.
No kidding.
And our company got a contract award to help revitalize the area. This is perfect for me because I know all the players in town. So now we're doing all these events. And our idea is to change the persona of the drug dealers and hookers and, you know, not safe after 10 o'clock at night and all of that, and create these activities for the city of Buffalo. And so I went to city planning meetings with the mayor and, you know, as an assistant, of course, but I watched the owner of my company conduct contractual negotiations as a general coordinator. And I had access to all of his paperwork for all of the events that they had been doing. And he was a highly organized man with a lot of theatrical background. So he brought a kind of enthusiasm to event planning that had a range to it that a lot of the other planning companies didn't have. And his understanding of props and understanding of visual presentation and his impeccable follow-through chops with a paper trail and good contract writing. And so I did that for 2.5 years. Formed the Western New York Jazz Society with Jim Patrick. Jim Patrick is perhaps the greatest living exponent on Charlie Parker. There is a 27-volume music reference book called The Groves Dictionary. He has the entry on Charlie Parker into it. And he, you know, is a Dartmouth graduate, a Princeton graduate. But more to the point, a real hipster, but a real intelligent guy. Very book-read and very book-smart, but also very street smart. And so it was our commonality with all of that that got us to put this company together. And we did, and we got a group of people to come on as honorary advisors. Most of them were luminaries, famous people who lent their name to our cause and would come and play for our events. So the upshot of all this, that went on for like 2.5 years, and I did two really big jazz festivals. One of them was, featured Maynard Ferguson and Billy Preston. Wow. And we got a deal because they were both working under the same agent at the time. But it was an outdoor event, and one day, free to the public, 110,000 people came. We had Grouchy fireworks do a closing thing, and it was big shit in those days.
Yeah.
You know, and Michael Pitek, who the owner of Events Unlimited, had tremendous range in his thinking, and really, I was privy to how the company operated, so I was able to like run my festival the way I ran the events for Events Unlimited, because that was my training. And meanwhile, I'm playing gigs around town still, and my children are growing up and all of that. And so in 1989, my father got ill, and I wanted my children to get to know him, so we moved to Florida. And I'm following the music the whole way, but I'm trying to make my domestic life work, too. And so I come down here, and I realize that, hey, man, all this time has gone by, and there's a jazz club here now, there's an opera house here now, there's ballet here now, mm-hmm. there's all of this stuff. And I went to the opera house. And I wanted to meet the people. I said, this is great. In my lifetime, within 100 miles of where I live, there is actual, real European culture. What can I do to help and get involved with this? And this woman who was running the operation, a banker from Chicago, was so rude to me. Now, we're not bumpkins here. We're not like country bumpkins. Don't come in here and think you can take over.
Is that what she said?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I said, what? You mean like you did?
Oh.
I mean, I didn't say that, but inside I'm going, there's daggers, you know.
Yeah.
Because we're supposed to be on the same team, and like she is polarizing it.
Yes.
by saying, guess what? The golden rule is, he who has the gold rules. You know, and guess what? You're not it.
Yeah.
There's that world of elitism showing
That's
up
right.
again.
That's right.
It's one of the nasty aspects of success in business. You get to snub people.
How I see it is that the people who are truly successful, and I don't just mean that they've reached the top of their profession, but that inside themselves they feel like that. They don't need to keep anybody out.
Well, that's a matter of spiritual advancement. You know, spiritual advancement doesn't get along real well with business, which is why business is not incredibly spiritual.
No, no.
And I've been at war with that all my life, trying to figure out the inequities. I have finally figured all of that out. A lot of it has to do with just letting go of old notions and getting out of choosing sides. Discernment without judgment, basically. Because as soon as you make a judgment, you get to be right.
Yeah. Well,
but it sucks you in to this dynamic of polarities inside that concept. Matter of fact, I went to Princeton this summer, to the Galansky Institute, and it was very interesting to see what has happened on the institutional, the high institutional level, now that elitism is gone. The downside is admitting stuff that doesn't belong. It's like, you got lamb and you got chicken wings. How about I pay the same amount that I pay for the chicken wings, for the lamb? Mm-hmm. Well, no. The lamb is a more sophisticated, more expensive, more valuable item.
Right.
That's why we charge $34.95 for it.
Right.
I'm going, but you don't understand, you know? So that's what has happened with the quality of things. It's kind of been blurred. But there's this real precarious deal going on where you're not allowed to draw distinctions of quality.
No.
Because that is termed elitism.
Elitism, right.
And where I come from, where I grew up, how I grew up, elitism was about the pursuit of excellence.
Yeah, I know. And the recognition that there is such a thing and everything isn't it.
That's right. The downside of elitism is that arrogant, exclusive, compartmentalizing, quick snap judgments. I mean, I've seen many musical careers destroyed by cruel teachers who didn't have the compassion to help this person come of age.
Right.
He immediately compared him to his best student and said, oh, you'll never get it.
Yeah.
You need to do something else. So the downside to the dumbing down is that a lot of stuff gets in that shouldn't get in. The upside is that there is no longer an environment or an atmosphere of fear like there was. I really remember not feeling the fear when I was at Princeton 2 summers ago. And this is a real high-level, interactive music situation where people are getting coached one-on-one in an audience-style thing. Well, I mean, there's like 200 people out here, and then who wants to get coached today? So someone comes up and
you know.
And like, but not really, because anymore everyone knows that whoever is getting coached is on the level that they're on.
Right.
We are not comparing this person with Horowitz today. And that why is he getting this kind of attention when he's not really that good?
Yeah.
That's bullshit. We don't do it like that anymore. We give everybody an equal shot. And I really like that. So anyway, I came back here in 1989, got involved with Jay Foley, I came down here to a job that he gave me. Jay Foley owned the Gator Club,
mm-hmm.
and he had Foley's before that downtown, which was a legendary nightclub on Main Street, where this place has always been a gathering for Southern rock and blues. You know, Greg Allman lives around here. Dickie Betts lives around here. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a big recording session where many of them used to do a lot of their recordings here. Guns N' Roses was recorded out on Fruitville Road. And so there was all of that around here. Meanwhile, jazz-wise, there's a huge poverty of bass players and drummers. There are people who will come through town who will stay, and then we'll go, well, not, the conversation's not very interesting here. I think I'm leaving. Same reason the Black Mountain Boys left and the Sag Harbor people left. I stayed because my children were still in school, and I was eking out ways to do this stuff, and somehow fortune has always smiled on me. The universe likes a made-up mind, and I've always been committed to playing.
What does that mean, the universe likes a made-up mind?
It means if you really commit to something, then the aftermath of that commitment will follow.
Will follow, got it.
So, and all through these years, I've been on these different spiritual disciplines. When I was in L.A., I learned about chanting from Herbie Hancock, and got seriously involved in that for like 23 years. Mm-hmm. Was a member of that, and same thing that Tina Turner does, and was involved in that. And read, you know, when I've gone to, went through all the EST seminars and all the Werner Erhard aftermath work of landmark technology. I did all of that work.
You just keep looking.
Yeah, not for some, but at this stage of my life, there are these points of coalescence that are amazing, where all of that wisdom, like I had a problem with the Christian philosophy because I was getting it through Ernest Angley and through Oral Roberts and through the evangelists of the time, you know, not to mention the hard sell Southern Baptists, you know, and all of them with a glint of a fanatic in their eye. And so somehow I couldn't really get next to the message they were teaching. And now here it is, I'm, you know, getting up there. And I'm reading a body of work now that's kind of tying it all together. All of it together. And it's funny, as after you live your life, especially if you have adhered to a way of life, it's a very unnerving thing to come to find out that what you have been adhering to is not right, not good, or that you could have been better than that. And I'm finding that I trusted myself all my life, even though I was angst-ridden over doing it because it didn't seem to work for anyone else. But I trusted my gut feeling about love being the ultimate power and about people, all people really want to be open to beauty. And all the things that I synthesized through paying attention to these great people and these great situations. So my music has taken on a different kind of aspect. I'm connected to what is for the higher purpose of everything. And today, I mean, there's, like I said, things have kind of settled down. I mean, if you're so great, how come you're not rich? Well, greatness isn't recognized today. And there are lots of different kinds of greatness. And greatness is continuance. If I might diverge to an esoteric tangent here.
Unknown for you.
I think that it is true that the fact that we are separate is an illusion. I think that we all have the same hopes and fears and wants and likes and dislikes. I think some of us are more awake than others. Some of us realize that pursuing becoming more awake is why we're here, and so that we become fuller people because of it. It's in the meantime, how do you not kill everybody else in the room? You know, how do you have your tolerance and your willingness to be as committed to their experience as you are to yours.
And let them have theirs. That's right. That's right. Let them have theirs.
Right. Right.
And not see it as a threat, as they see yours. I spend a lot of time these days reading The Tao Te Ching.
The Lao Tzu?
That's Lao Tzu.
You know, I have a Lao Tzu story.
Do you?
One day, he was out walking, and he passed by the water hole where the women were washing clothes. And a bear came up and started mauling one of the children. And he could do stuff with a stick that people were doing with swords.
Right.
And he had a stick. And he walked over, and he was just about ready to deliver this lethal blow when he realized no one should die here. So he played with the bear until the bear got bored and left.
Yes. No one should die here.
You know, there should be no violence here.
That's right.
And so that really resonated with me, learning how to move so that nobody gets hurt. You know, all of my teachers are still with me. I did a transatlantic crossing for the jazz club with my jazz trio. Mm-hmm. My wife and I take a trip every year and go abroad. So we were in Greece anyway. So we flew from Athens to Lisbon and took the ship. And we had passenger status and were treated like royalty. Mm-hmm. And so I had this very gastronomically disturbing meal, okay, eating all this rich food. Mm-hmm. And it was Thanksgiving Day. And here we are, 1,000 miles from land. In the middle of the drink, I can't sleep. So I go topside to the hot tub, which is an open air on the top deck, and just lay in and watch the clouds. I'm going, this is cool. Immediately became aware of the fact that there are no radio waves around me. I could feel the lack of electromagnetic pollution. Mm-hmm. And the clarity that I had in my thinking was profound. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm going, well, today's Thanksgiving. So I said, I think I'm going to give thanks for all my teachers. So I went back all the way to kindergarten, my kindergarten teacher, and I tried to picture their face and remember their name. And all my teachers, Skeeter was in there. Mm-hmm. And I went all the way through all my high school teachers and college teachers, and then teachers I had met on the street, you know, homeless people I had met who had told me stuff that I remember, people I'll never see again. And there's a spirituality that I have been drawn toward from the beginning. And I'm really glad I've stayed with it and not gotten into the group consensus of, you know, geez, your pants look really funny. Well, that's how they're wearing them now, you know. You know, it was never like that. I just do my own thing and march to the beat of my own drummer. But you know what's marvelous? Is I'm finding out that everyone else has that distinction too. The regret and the elation is proportionate to
how much you continued. Right. Yeah, you know, how much you went with it.
You know, so trusting yourself is a big deal in the face of, you know, your mom and your dad telling you that, you know, what do you mean you want to be a piano player? You should be a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah.
You're very smart. I mean, there's a lot of the old school stuff I like. And I'm more in the loss of attention spans. People have no attention span today. They've been hoodwinked by the media.
They've been sound bitten.
Right. They've been hoodwinked by the media into letting the media dream them instead of the imagination training that comes. You know, there are no neighborhoods anymore.
Yeah,
I had a neighborhood when I was growing up. We had a bunch of kids who would play ball on the street. We'd climb trees, and we would build forts. And
neighbors would watch out for you, and everybody had everybody's key.
Yeah.
I had that, too. And I grew up in New York City.
And in those days, without all the high-tech bullshit, I mean, you figured it out in the summertime. And you figured it out with the addition of something that is now missing. Time to be with yourself. Time to lay on your back and make shapes out of clouds. Mm-hmm. You know, very, very high-end imagination training. I mean, your ability to formulate things out of nothing is another kind of reality. I've come to believe through all this great stuff that has happened in my life that thinking great thoughts are the best thing that I can contribute. I used to think that in the face of corporate world, the individual has no power. And I don't believe that anymore. I believe that the entire world can turn on one person's illumination.
We're going to need to stop soon.
Okay.
So...
any kind of wrap-up, or...?
That was what I was going to ask you. Usually I ask people, they want to say something about living a life as an artist, but that is what you've been talking about. You've been talking about living a life of commitment to all the arts, to intellectual and artistic excellence. But if there's something else you want to say, please do.
There is. I have no regrets. I mean, I wish I had more money. I wish I could fund some of the more ambitious projects that I have in my mind. But I have no regrets. I like who I am. At my age, I still love making music more than anything. I love walks outside. I'm very appreciative of life. My health is good. My mind is good. Hey, man. I found a piece that was written by T.S. Eliot called Four Quartets.
Mm-hmm.
What it's like being an artist.
Mm-hmm.
What there is to discover has already been discovered by a man whom we can never hope to emulate. But perhaps neither gain nor loss. For us, there's only the trying. The rest is not our business. Isn't that nice?
Yeah. Thank you, Michael Royal.
Thanks for inviting me.
And we're going to go out on a cut from Michael's CD. Richard Drexler on bass and Steve Davis on drums. Thank you.